All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey, it's Kyle Meredith, host of the Kyle Meredith With Podcast, presented by WFPK at WFPK.org and the Consequence Podcast Network. It's a series that puts the spotlight on iconic musicians and actors, inviting them to drop by and talk about their latest projects, whether it's albums, TV shows, films, or beyond.
I'm going to say something I don't want to say. Here it goes.
Without Spinal Tap, there is no Tenacious D.
Whoa. Man.
We get great stories and the biggest scoops from people like Garbage's Shirley Manson, the 1975's Matty Healy, Jack Black and Kyle Gass of Tenacious D, Maya Hawke, Kiefer Sutherland, and everyone in between. New episodes arrive every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, so it's a great way to keep up with your favorite artists and discover some new ones. You can find Kyle Meredith With on the Consequence Podcast Network or wherever you get your podcasts.
Borahe Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
Hello, Opus listener. This is Mijan Zulu, lead podcast producer at Consequence. I'm here today in celebration of the 50th anniversary of hip hop. To celebrate, we're opening up the Opus podcast archives to re-release seasons focused on some of history's most legendary rap albums. First up, we are going to revisit Fuji's classic, The Score, which comes in at number 15 on Consequence's list of the 50 greatest hip hop albums of all time. You can see the full list at Consequence, and there'll be loads of artist interviews, essays, and more coming out throughout the month. So make sure to check it all out at consequence.net. You can also snag some of our exclusive hip-hop merch at the Consequence shop. You can find that at shop.consequence.net. And here on The Opus, we're going to keep the party going as we'll be re-releasing episodes about Cypress Hill's self-titled record. So make sure to check back here every Wednesday and Friday for fresh episodes from the archives. Now, let's dive into Fuji's The Score and a happy hip-hop 50th.
Pop culture in 1995 was really something else. Across mediums, everybody was at the top of their game, and if they weren't, they were in the middle of something extra. Every decade has a point within it that defines and pivots the culture. And 1995 was one of those years for the 90s. In 95, Michael Jordan unretired. Amazon sold its first book online. The OJ trial was everywhere. And music. Everybody was doing just great. There was one music festival here in Chicago that had a lineup that was Bush, Collective Soul, Duran Duran, Faith No More, KMFDM, Sheryl Crow, Sponge, and the Stone Roses. And then a month later, another festival in the Fuji's home state of New Jersey had Blackstreet, Brandy, Method Man, Naughty by Nature, Shabba Ranks, Soul for Real, and the Notorious B.I.G. Speaking of Biggie, hip-hop was in a really interesting spot. It was in the middle of a second golden age that saw some newer artists starting to take over the charts and create some instant classics. And the first generation that grew up listening to hip-hop was ready to grab the baton. Hip-hop had been around long enough that no one acting in good faith could call it a fad, and no one in the industry who was interested in making money, and everybody was interested in making money, had to accept that hip-hop was becoming one of the most popular and the most profitable genres in America. And it was spreading. When the Fugees entered the Booga Basement in East Orange, New Jersey, they had little reason to believe that they would emerge months later with one of those instant classics. That album would propel them to the top of the charts and the front row at every award show. That in a year filled to the absolute brim with music that we still talk about and listen to, that their sophomore effort would rise like cream to the top. So what made the score stand out as great in a sea of excellence? And how did it carve out its own lane on a massively busy hip-hop highway? In this episode of The Opus, we'll hear from some very talented people, some of whom were involved in the making of the Fugees' masterpiece, and some are just talented people who are big, big fans. And one thing that everybody I've spoken to, including me, has in common: none of us can believe that the score is 25 years old. For Consequence of Sound and Sony Legacy, I'm Jill Hopkins, and this is The Opus. Let's go. Soldiers, left, right, left, right. It's time I settle the score. Left, right, left, right, left. It's time I settle the score. Ripple to the rum to the ripple, single. But the times I come in triple. In the 1980s, hip hop made a name for itself. But it was still kind of a niche interest. It peaked into the mainstream, but when the mainstream tried to dip its toe into hip hop, let me tell you, it was embarrassing. That's how we ended up with an entire Rodney Dangerfield rap thing and the Super Bowl shuffle. Go Bears. And the 90s changed all of that. I mean, things still had the potential to be very, very cheesy. But by and large, hip-hop was at an artistic high. And for the first time, its artists became superstars in their own right. I mean, we still had people pushing the Bartman and the Urkel on the kids, but massive hits put the genre firmly at the top of the heap, and that's a position from which it's really never looked back. Hell, it's built all new heaps. Heaps over in pop music, heaps over in country music, heaps all over the world. But even though hip-hop was moving units and shaking asses, in the early 90s, hip-hop was at a crossroads. The success of gangster rap led to a lot of radio stations pulling, or at least trying to pull, boycotts against hip-hop's more aggressive artists. And to make matters worse for the industry and for the artists, Gilbert O'Sullivan had a successful court case against Biz Markie in 1991. The Biz had used a sample of O'Sullivan's Alone Again Naturally without consent, and that threatened to change the game. Producers couldn't use multiple samples all willy-nilly. So the Fugees found themselves creatively with a lot of decisions to make if they wanted to sell more records than they had with their first album. And they'd have to find a way to be authentic to their East Coast but not New York hip-hop inclinations. They'd have to take advantage of the new attention Lauren was getting from Sister Act 2, and they'd have to figure out how to showcase Wyclef and Praz's Haitian heritage, which is an important thing for this group that was formerly known as the Refugees to make known. We're going to explore all of those points as the season goes on. But let's take a look at the score from the front. All them kids that try to do this for all the wrong reasons. Seasons change, mad things rearrange, but it all stays the same like the love Doctor Strange. I'm tame like the rapper. Get red like a snapper when they do that. Got your whole block saying true that. If only they knew that. It was you who was irregular. I remember the mid-90s really well. I was in high school, And when you're young and you're obsessed with something, you soak it up like a sponge. And I kind of missed that, actually. I was obsessed with music, which, haha, my guidance counselor, paid off. So when The Score came out, I was all about it. And so were the other kids I knew. The Score was one of those albums that the jocks had, and the nerds had, and the hip-hop heads had, and the metal heads had. It was a unifier. I wanted to talk to somebody that I was in school with to see if I was remembering things correctly. This is Psalm 1. She's a rapper, and she was a rapper even then. She's also an activist, and she lives in Minnesota now. But she's a former classmate of mine who had her world rocked by The Score.
I went out that day and got the tape from Coconuts. And it's like, this is the era where you had to leave your house, go to the store, buy it with your money. How are you not going to listen to it? Like, people, like, we take streaming for granted now. You just get it on your phone, and you may listen to it, you may not. You may listen to the whole thing, you may not. But when you go out and you spend your good-earned, hard-earned cash, you know, you're finna immerse yourself in it.
Psalm raises a really good point here about streaming and how we take in music now. You can grab a single, you can grab a sample, you can download anything from anywhere, basically, and carry it around in your pocket. But in the 90s, we were with, you know, the exception of DJs, who'll always scoop up singles. We were in an album-based culture. But albums were expensive, especially if you were in high school. But, on the other hand, artists actually got paid, and labels had money to just throw around. That brings us to Chris Schwartz. He, along with Joe Nicolo, were the heads, and are the heads, of Rough House Records. They signed the Fugees and counted Cypress Hill, Tim Dog, and Criss Cross, among a bunch of others, as part of their roster.
In the 90s, it became really an album format, right? It became very conceptual. You started hearing records, you know, like Cypress and the Fugees, and they were approaching albums as an overall thing rather than just stringing a bunch of songs together in a long play configuration. I think the audience became more kind of discerning in a way that the audiences became album buyers, right? Yeah. And so I think that was part of it. The budgets changed, you know, we kind of, the industry broke out of the traditional 60s and 70s, you know, give the rock bands a lot of money, give the black artists, like, you know, less dollars for production and everything like that. Mm-hmm. Because these albums, you know, let's face it, we were in the CD age, right?
Yep.
CD came out in 1983. It was a co-venture between Philips and Sony. And a CD in 1983 costs about $4 to $5 to manufacture. That's why CDs were so expensive. An album costs about $1.75. So now we're moving into the late 80s into the early 90s. CDs are now the ubiquitous go-to configuration. CDs, by the early 90s, when you're doing volume, are now 68 cents to manufacture. That's for the CD, the artwork on the CD, the jewel case, four color separated gatefold, everything, because it was all automated. Albums were still like $1.75 to $2.25. Both configurations, you're gonna spend about $4 marketing promotion. Yet, although the CDs went down in manufacturing price, the wholesale and retail prices kept going up. So, because the major distribution powers figured that, well, we believe it's the best entertainment value for your money. So there was more money. There was more revenue for the labels, for the artists and everything. And that sort of paradigm had also created this whole new age of entrepreneurship with artists and producers and everything. But it made the people weren't banging out records in 2 weeks. Now people were taking, it was kind of like the way major rock projects get made.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that had a lot to do with it. You had also, you know, the profit margins on CDs combined with the growing worldwide popularity of hip hop. It was kind of like the perfect storm.
It was the right record at the right time. Ready or not. and people were willing to pay for quality. But in 1995, not a whole lot of people knew that the sophomore album from the Fugees would be the high-quality content that would move hip-hop fans to buy. Ooh, but people sure did buy it.
Now that I escape, sleep, walk, awake. Those who correlate know the world ain't cake. Jail bars ain't golden gates. Those who fake, they break. When they meet their 400-pound mate, if I could rule the world, everyone would have a gun in the ghetto, of course. When get the up and on their horse. Kick around, drinking moonshine. I pour a sip on the concrete for the deceased. But no, don't weep. White Clef's in a state of sleep, thinking about the robbery that I did last week.
At the top of 1995, the Fugees were between albums. Their first album was called Blunted on Reality, and it did okay. Here's Chris Schwartz again.
If you looked at the time in black music, in the charts and everything, and this was like right after the advent of SoundScan, that your first 2 weeks were your biggest week. And then after that, you kind of like set your sales patterns happen. And so they never had a big first 2 weeks. They had a nothing first 2 weeks. But well over 2 years after that record was released, it was still selling 600 to 800 copies a week SoundScan. Now, you have to know that is an absolute anomaly. Because 6,800 copies a week SoundScan is a record that shipped 50,000 copies in its first 2 weeks, 8 months ago. Not a record that shipped nothing 2 years ago. So a lot of people don't know that. That like that 6,800 copies a week, that means that 6,800 people a week, 2 years later, were buying this record. Meaning that this group was out gaining an audience and touring and relentlessly just working. The record didn't do that well. Be that it is as it may, it was still, to me, an important record, just for that very fact alone.
And it was important enough to get their contract re-upped. Here's Joe Nicolo.
So it was time to pick up the Fugees option, which me and Chris were definitely going to do. And I remember that the first record had sold about 119,000 copies. And Sony was like, back then, 119,000 copies. Well, again, with the machine and the videos and all that you had to put into it, they were like, "Well, you're gonna pass on picking up the Fugees option, aren't you?" And we were looked at them like, "Put the glue down, man." I mean, it's like this record, this had just started to happen at the very end of that record. Of course, we're gonna do another record.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, go ahead, it's your money. You know, you're spending your Cypress Hill crisscross money, so go ahead.
They spent $135,000 of that Cypress Hill crisscross money. And they spent it on the advance for the score. The Fugees took the bulk of that to the Booga basement. It was the basement of the house where Wyclef and Proz's cousin, Jerry Wanda Duplessis, lived. The Booga basement would become legendary. But in 1995, it was less of a studio space and more of a... It was just a basement with stuff in it. Recording stuff, microphones, boards, speakers. There was a big old thing with, you know, a lot of knobs and buttons. And it was fitting. And it was great because the Fugees were at that part of the Drake song just above the bottom and not really anywhere near here. Here's Jerry Wanda.
Everybody was in a beginning of being a better writer or we get into production.
Mm-hmm.
So the Booga Basement was a way to start our own production company where we producing people, being a producer. So we started, I went and got the equipment, Wyclef and I, my brother, Rennell, and we did that. So that's what great about that album was, like, there was no session. There was no studio time. It was like, we just go, and it was right there, creating, everybody creating. You know, you have people like John Forte, you have other people that was a part of the whole thing. It wasn't just the three Fugees, but it was all of us team up together to make it, and that was a vibe. It was like a team, a band together. So that's what, you know, that helped us later on to say, oh my God, we could do it. And people wanted that sound too, believe it or not.
Chris Schwartz.
you started hearing records, you know, like Cypress and the Fugees, where they're employing skits between the songs.
Oh, yeah, we have to talk about the skits. Just for a second. And not just the skits on this album, not just the score skits. Skits on hip-hop albums in general. I get it. You're telling a story with an album. It's a narrative. You want to show off your humor. You want to connect the different parts of the album. You want to create character arcs. You want to give the homies a spot to shine. I get it. But for every D's Nuts, there are 20 Chinese restaurant skits. Which is to say, they can't all be gold. The score is such a great listen from start to finish, though, that you can, if you want, go ahead and skip the skits and not lose any quality. We all laughed at different things 25 years ago. There are episodes of Friends more problematic than anything on this album, but context is important. And it's important to acknowledge how far we've come. We all learn and grow if we're lucky.
Word them up, y'all.
Born the town, the beast is loose.
Come on.
Conflicts with nightsticks, illegal sales districts, handpicked lunatics, keep all attrictions rich, heretics. Push narcotics amidst this risks and frisks. Cool clicks, throw bricks, but seldom get targets. Private dicks sell hits like porno flicks to chicks. The 666 cut wick like Luke and Gritch sucks dick.
Meanwhile, the government brings Star Wars.
So the score was the right record at the right time. And this time, the mid-90s, is important in a way that's very specific to hip-hop. A genre that at the time was not yet even 20 years old. What that meant was that the Fugees and their contemporaries, who were only in their mid-20s themselves, were the first generation of black music makers to have grown up not just on R&B and soul and rock and roll, but to have grown up on hip-hop. This generation of MCs and DJs were borrowing from and paying homage to their roots, like every era of musicians do. But for the first time, they had the beats and rhymes of the foundation of hip-hop to pull from, too. And that influence was hugely on display on the score. This album is an amazing curation of samples and covers that make this album have not just the kind of staying power that makes it worth talking about 25 years later, but a lingering power that sustained this February release all the way through until the next February at the Grammy Awards.
And the best rap album is The Fugees.
We're going to make this real quick. We like to big up East Coast and West Coast, one love. At this moment, let's not forget the refugees in Zaire going through this bad situation right now. Nor the refugees in Haiti. We want to thank Sony, the record company, for making
everyone I've spoken to about the score, whether they had hands in the making of it or not, is just a big champion of this record. And everyone has their favorite parts of it. Psalm 1, who's a lyricist.
I be Nina Simone defecating on your microphone. Defecate? Are you serious? And I remember what Diamond D, he said precision and then said, I leave lyrical incisions. And then, of course, the ubiquitous bing, like that's what you knew. That's what you and Wyclef came in with the bing in the album. That's what you knew you had said something.
And she agrees with me about a standout bar on Zealots. This lyric in Zealots, and even after all my logic and my theory, I add a mother so you ignorant hear me, is just
whoa!
Like,
whoa!
Roll like, that back. Roll it back.
Because it was logic, theory. Come on. Ignorance. Because it's just like, for me, I grew up in like my formative years were going, I was going to like advanced placement classes and like smart schools, but I lived in the hood. So that lyric was just like, okay, like you can be a smart person, and rap, because, you know, there are so many smart people that rap, so many people who are like intelligent or whatever, of course, but that's not what they feed us. That's not what they tell us.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of times it's like, is this person just gangsta or are they actually like intelligent, you know? And, and I think as a kid, hearing these raps and hearing these rappers let me know that like my nerdy ass could be cool through this art form.
And Jerry Wonder just loved it all.
I play every song because every song touched me as a writer, composer. Every song is not just the hit that people call the hit. Whenever I listen to a song, it just brings memories to me. Where were we? What moment were we at? Like if I listen to Cowboys, you know, what that means, how many mics, what that means, you know, the score, what that means. And, you know, even the skits, I remember that, you know, we have Roz Bowalker, which is a part of the album. So, you know, Roz Bowalker is the mayor of Newark, New Jersey.
Yeah.
And, you know, so you got Roz, you got, you know, all of them came to the basement to record. And I just, every song on the album, if you ask me for what's my favorite, I don't have a favorite. They all bring memory. They're all special to me. They're my babies. It's like, tell me which kid I like better than that. They're all my babies. That score album, I could listen to it over and over. And every piece of it, I remember what happened, and it was a moment.
We're going to hear a lot more from Jerry and Chris and Joe and everyone else in the next episodes of The Opus. Episode 2 takes us down to the Booga basement, where lightning was captured in a bottle. And we find out that where you make an album can influence the art itself. This season won't leave us subterranean, though. We'll look at the score's rise from the literal underground to Haiti, to New Jersey, to the top of the charts, to multi-platinum status. For Consequence of Sound and Sony Legacy, this has been The Opus. I'm Jill Hopkins. I'll see you next time. Don't play tough, cause I reverse the earth and turn your flesh back to dust. Ooh la la la, it's the way that we rock when we doing our thing. Ooh la la la, it's the natural law that the refugees bring. Ooh la 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 la. So we, hey. Shalom, Illinois, the reform. Dig it. I stay high off the Fuji live bus when we rush through. You must know raw cuss crew got G's like the refuse. So F who ever wanna test, bring me stress. West coast back to east. Grab my toast when I reach truly curving, swerving. Lifestyle is urban, sipping bourbon, surviving. We really keep the word when a boy wanna be tested.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey, it's Kyle Meredith, host of the Kyle Meredith With podcast, presented by WFPK at WFPK.org and the Consequence Podcast Network. It's a series that puts the spotlight on iconic musicians and actors, inviting them to drop by and talk about their latest projects, whether it's albums, TV shows, films, or beyond.
I'm going to say something I don't want to say. Here it goes.
Without Spinal Tap, there is no Tenacious D.
Whoa. Man.
We get great stories and the biggest scoops from people like Garbage's Shirley Manson, the 1975's Matty Healy, Jack Black and Kyle Gass of Tenacious D, Maya Hawke, Kiefer Sutherland, and everyone in between. New episodes arrive every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, so it's a great way to keep up with your favorite artists and discover some new ones. You can find Kyle Meredith With on the Consequence Podcast Network or wherever you get your podcasts.
Borahe Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
Here in America, work is in trouble.
We've offshored our manufacturing, sent away good jobs, and lost so much ability to make things. American Giant is a company that's pushing back against this tide. They make high-quality clothing, sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more right here in the USA. Visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, promo code STAPLE20.